The Safari Park.
You're killing me, Larry.
Hello, Larry.
Hats off to Larry.
Larry. Fucking Larry.
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 Larry. Larry, get into bed now.
Is there no sweeter sound than that of your own name buried in cheers and applause? Well, I think not.
There's a time for living. The time keeps on flying. Think you're loving, baby, and all you're doing is crying.
Hey, who's that soulful troubadour? Why, it's Charlie. Charlie Manson, of course, who slipped these earthly shackles just a week ago or so. Nothing strange about that, but what is strange is thousands, maybe tens of thousands, will seriously mourn his death. That deserves some investigation, doesn't it? America has a full-on crush on psychos, particularly serial killers and mass murderers. Why is that? I, too, feel a small void deep down about Charlie's passing. To be sure, though, it's a fascination, not admiration. We're often more intrigued by monsters than good guys, aren't we? There's more books on Hitler than every American president, maybe every world leader combined, right? Manson was, for nearly half a century, an inexhaustible font of entertainment. Of course, not for the victims or their families, but as Woody Allen said, tragedy plus time equals comedy. And Charlie could be a very funny little creep. He once gave a jailhouse interview to Geraldo Rivera. It got huge, huge ratings, and shortly afterwards I was watching this comic, maybe it was Mario Cantone, I'm not sure. He asked his audience, by a show of hands, how many of them had seen the Manson-Rivera interview. And then he asked, also by show of hands, how many were hoping Manson would kill Geraldo. He got a big laugh and a full show of hands. That instant demonstrated something about Charlie and the way we felt about him, didn't it? Charlie stood, all 62 inches of him, unchallenged for 5 decades at the top of the psycho killer heap. Nobody's come close in terms of fame, even though he's been eclipsed by dozens of other psycho killers in terms of body count. The United States needs to up its psycho killer game because we only clock in at position number 8 with Washington State's own Gary Ridgway, better known as the Green River Killer, with 49 confirmed kills, but he may have offed as many as 90. And the number 1 position from South America is Luis Garavito, nicknamed the Beast, with 138 confirmed kills, although he's suspected of killing over 300. And the list goes on. And Charlie doesn't even crack that top 100. He truly was a lightweight. But still, he remains the only bona fide rock star in his field. They've sold serial killer trading cards for years now, with stats just like Major League Baseball cards, runs, hits, errors, and HBIs, that's heads bashed in. Why are we so fascinated with these guys? And they're not all guys. There's been a few females in the bunch, too. Aileen Wuornos, the truck stop hooker, who was played by Charlize Theron, very pointy, in the movie Monster. She knocked off a bunch of guys. Charlie had an achievement that few people ever realized. He brought psycho killing out of the shadows and made it a glamour crime. He really did. Charlie was kind of a precursor to Cyndi Lauper, who married rock and wrestling. Charlie managed to marry murder with Hollywood stars and the Beatles. I mean, that's impressive, isn't it? And had it not been for one of his big-mouthed female zombies bragging to her cellmate about having killed Sharon Tate, Charlie might never have been caught. And Manson, whose harem is alleged to have included up to 35 women, gave the world possibly the very worst part of his twisted legacy, what many of us in the know call Manson Chicks. What are Manson Chicks? Well, I'll post some images on my homepage at thatlarryshow.com for your viewing pleasure or horror. The top three Manson Chicks were those who were true blue and stuck by Charlie through decades of his imprisonment. And they were Susan Atkins, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Leslie Van Houten. They were all far from pointy. They all had a 10-yard stare and permanent smiles under lipless mouths fixed on pasty faces that said, "I'm a psycho, and if you even breathe near me, you'll get a venereal disease." Kind of like Elizabeth Warren. Where do these women come from? How do they achieve that look? It's almost as if they work at it. You have to wonder what Charlie's seduction game was. It's said that he acquired many of his girls when they were hitchhiking. Can you imagine what that was like? Charlie rolling along in a rusting shitbox 1961 Rambler American. It's late afternoon on some dusty two-lane blacktop in the desert north of Los Angeles. Maybe a little spur off Highway 14 up around the Antelope Valley. The sunlight is still golden and warm, but already there's a slight chill in the air, as there always is at day's end in the desert. He sees some skinny hippie chick on the shoulder in a gingham dress and mammy oakum boots. She's a little bit cold and a lot hungry. She's got her thumb out and an unmistakable aura about her that says, "Somebody, anybody, please lead me." You can always spot these types. They are cult fodder. Charlie slows down for a look.
Hey there, foxy lady. Need a ride?
Hello.
Are you wondering who I am, darling? Well, I'm the nicest homicidal dwarf with bad teeth and gonorrhea you'll ever meet. But that still puts me several notches above your daddy, don't it?
Yes.
Come on, get in. Soon, you'll be eating out of dumpsters and slicing up total strangers. If all goes according to plan, you'll spend the rest of your life in prison.
I love you.
Soon, they'd be at the ranch. That being Spawn's Movie Ranch up in the Santa Susana Pass, a location around which I have hiked extensively. I've stood under the very same rock where Charlie and the family had their class picture taken just before they were given their psycho killer diplomas. Kind of a weird feeling, and in a nutty twist of fate, what now stands on that bloody desert floor where Spawn's ranch once stood? A church. George Spawn, the owner, was a blind old man when Charlie came to call with the family. They needed a place to stay, and once Charlie's demon angels got to work on old George, well, he was perfectly fine with letting them stay as long as they wanted. Were George not blind, he probably would have rather bedded a mule. See, Charlie had a formula. He knew that there were legions of lonely chicks that just never got invited to the prom. Most of them had awful relationships with Daddy, and so they were easy pickings for Charlie. All he had to do was show them a little affection, a little attention, and, well, there would be no telling what they might do for him. And so he'd take them up to the ranch. By dusk, it looked kind of cozy. It was, after all, a Western movie set. They'd build a big campfire and huddle close around it under Indian blankets. It was like summer camp with a very special counselor, a counselor that had just dosed your Franks and beans with enough LSD to send Moby Dick to Jupiter. In the evenings, a desert wind would always kick up, and if you looked up at the sky, you'd see more stars than ever lived in Hollywood. And stars mattered, because Charlie, your special camp counselor, was gonna be a star. A long-haired, denim-jeaned, buckskin shirt guitar strumming, song singing, magic music man.
Pretty girl. Pretty, pretty girl. Cease to exist. Just come and say you love me. Give up your world. Come on, you can't be. I'm your king.
More than anything, Charlie wanted to be a rock star. And eventually, he would be, but in a league of his own. Over the years, there have been countless theories about why Manson orchestrated what the press always termed, quote, senseless murders, unquote. Many say they were drug deals gone bad. Then there was the most commonly accepted theory that Crazy Charlie was trying to ignite a race war. But I believe Charlie snapped because he had been Hollywooded. What's that, you ask? Well, people in entertainment tend to have a lot of similarities. One is that when they meet someone new, they automatically assume that person is a moron. And that's somewhat understandable because many Hollywood types make enormous sums of money for very little work, and so assume they themselves must be demigods. The other assumption they make is that no matter how they fuck someone over, the fucky will magically evaporate, and their paths will never cross again. They also assume that people around the world understand their industry code, which is, quote, silence means no, unquote. In other industries, in other parts of the planet, people have no trouble telling other people that they have no interest in what they're selling. But in Hollywood, nobody has the balls to say no. They just go into radio silence. And so somehow, Charlie became acquainted with Dennis Wilson of the Beach Boys. And pretty soon, Charlie and then the entire family had moved into Dennis's mansion on Sunset Boulevard. After a while, Dennis realized he may have made a little mistake, so he moved out of his own mansion and left Charlie and his gang behind. Dennis was so terrified of Charlie, he kept paying the bills. In one summer alone, Charlie's family racked up $100,000 in expenses, most of which was for antibiotics for the various STDs they all kept passing around like a canteen. Finally, Dennis Wilson got his manager and some muscle to persuade Charlie and the family to move out. And somewhere along the line, Charlie met a guy named Terry Melcher, who had produced some Beach Boys records. And Charlie did a demo for Terry, and Terry said he liked its sound, and there was talk of an album and even a movie about Charlie and his family. One of the Manson chicks says Melcher had made concrete promises. And then Terry, like Dennis, saw the violent side of Charlie and thought better of making him a recording star. And Terry, instead of gently and nicely easing out of Charlie's life, did just what he'd probably always done. He Hollywooded Charlie. Just went into radio silence. Maybe he figured Charlie, though a Hollywood outsider, was also a moron, but still had sufficient brains to recognize the silence means no code. Trouble was, Charlie was not a moron, and to him, Terry's code was interpreted as silence means fuck you. And Charlie seethed. And so Sharon Tate and company were living in the home formerly occupied by Terry the night Charlie's minions came calling with their knives and gun, and the rest is part of the lurid lore of the City of Angels. Why did Charles Manson captivate the country for nearly half a century? What was it about him? Countless books, Multiple movies and TV shows have been made about him. The Beach Boys, Guns N' Roses, Marilyn Manson, Neil Young, Ozzy Osbourne, Sonic Youth, Nine Inch Nails, and many other musical acts have paid homage to Charlie. His face has adorned t-shirts, coffee mugs, lapel buttons, jewelry, the list goes on. What makes his popularity even more astonishing was that his fame was launched during one of the most crowded news cycles of the 20th century, the summer of 69. It was jam-packed with earth-shaking stories. The moon landing, the Woodstock Rock Festival, Ted Kennedy's Chappaquiddick death scandal, and Hurricane Camille, which took 259 lives. What's happened to those stories since then? Vast groups of imbeciles now claim the moon landing was a simulation. Woodstock has long faded into the mists of music legend. Nobody remembers the most important story of all, at least by body count, the hurricane. And Teddy Kennedy, Charlie Manson's contemporary, went on to occupy a seat in the United States Senate for 47 years. Now think about this. Charlie Manson was never proven to have partaken in a single murder for which he was convicted. He was called the Mastermind. And doubtless he was. Yet, a married Ted Kennedy, after attending a party, drove his Oldsmobile off a causeway bridge with a much younger, quite attractive staff member named Mary Jo Kopechne. Teddy was a big dude, in good shape at 37 and a hell of a swimmer. The car was not in deep water. Teddy managed to escape the car, but he left behind Mary Jo. Was Teddy loaded? Well, we'll never know. Because Teddy calmly walked back to his place and after a 10-hour, that's right, 10-hour huddle with his political spin doctors, then Senator Kennedy decided to call the cops and tell them there was a girl in his car submerged in a pond. Might Mary Jo have lived had Teddy acted more quickly and not been worried about covering his fat, privileged coward's ass? Here's what one of the first responders, John Farrar, a rescue diver, had to say at the inquest. Quote, "It looked as if she were holding herself up to get a last breath of air. It was a consciously assumed position. She did not drown. She died of suffocation in her own air void. It took her at least 3 or 4 hours to die. I could have had her out of that car 25 minutes after I got the call. But Ted Kennedy did not call." Unquote. Ted Kennedy did what he did just 3 weeks before Charlie did what he ordered others to do. And Teddy became an elder statesman, respected and revered in life and in death. Even though he was a renowned lush and sexually harassed multiple women right up until his death. I know one of those women personally. She's cool. And Ted Kennedy was a fat sack of shit. Funny what time and spin doctors can do to history, isn't it? What's my personal connection to Manson? Nothing. Other than the same ghoulish fascination with a weird and evil gnome. But I'm certainly not alone in my fascination with Charlie. The Bel Air home where the Tate murders occurred was eventually bulldozed and the address deleted from city maps. But I worked with a so-called captain of industry who was so obsessed with Charlie, when he heard the house was for sale, he whistled up the corporate jet and flew to L.A. from New York, pretending he was interested in buying the house. For the longest time, some pals and I invented and played a game centered around Charlie that gave us no end of laughs. We called it the Manson Challenge. It went like this. Our mission was to shoehorn the name Charles Manson into as many conversations, whether personal or work-related, and just see what the reaction might be. For instance, my friend Bobby's out on a dinner date and asks the girl if she thinks Charles Manson liked cream in his coffee. And then he asks the waiter if Charles Manson had ever dined at that restaurant. Or I might have been in a staff meeting and after watching some torpid PowerPoint presentation comment that while it was good, Charles Manson could probably have tightened it up a bit. The look on people's faces was priceless. We'd all meet for drinks and tell our stories of the Manson Challenge and laugh until we nearly puked. It was nutty. So now there's a void in the American monster zeitgeist. Sure, O.J. is still around, as are other famous murderers, but who can possibly replace Charlie? In his own way, he was as unique and famed as his beloved Beatles. Hey, everybody. Thanks for hanging with me again here at the dojo. It's always great to see you. We've got some kick-ass content coming up for you right around the corner. First, as those of you know who've been with me from the start, we have a big, big anniversary coming up, the first birthday of That Larry Show. It all began December 13 last year, and in celebration of that, I'll be doing a special Atomic Goss Bomb Show, Judgment Day 2017. We're going to go back, way back, and reveal secrets surrounding this show that will blow up your skirt. It will drop on the 13th, so remember that date, 12, 13, 17. It's a bonus episode, only for the folks who keep the lights on here at the dojo. So, slide over to patreon.com/thatlarryshow and join the Patreon today. Now, before the atomic goss bomb, oh, it's so secret, I can't even mention the names who will get sprayed with fallout. Just use your imagination. Before the atomic goss bomb episode, I'll have the one I've been telling you about hopefully by this Thursday. How not to be a victim. It's step number one in ensuring you take no shit, so don't miss it. Follow the show on Facebook. Just search for That Larry Show, and you'll find it. Twitter, too, same address. And if something's bugging you, drop me an email at thatlarryshow@gmail.com, and I or one of our fantastic senseis will get on it chop chop and help you kick your troubles ass. Now, is there a moral to this story? Maybe. For evildoers with a cowardly streak. Whether a chicken shit hippie dwarf who manipulated others to do his killing for him, or a chicken shit politician who valued his political career over a human life. Remember, power, influence, and a magical last name beats the hell out of a swastika between your eyes. I'll see you next Tuesday, even sooner at the Patreon Dojo. And until that time, take no shit.